This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Time to put on the show.
Beauty before age. I guess that's the approach in this weekend's conference championship games. We get the young up-and-comers, Patrick Mahomes versus Josh Allen, as the preliminary course brought on by the, I would think that is the older fellas. You'd give them the earlier, the matinee performance so they could get their early bird specials, but then it's going to be Rodgers versus Tom Brady, and you've got two different generations of quarterbacks here.
Beauty before age. Well, the oldest quarterback may be the most beautiful, but that's neither here nor there. Yeah, it's interesting to watch this because, Danny, I think we're going to see with both Patrick Mahomes and Josh Allen, these two are going to, you would think, be playing in a lot of games like this to perhaps decide the AFC going forward.
I agree with that about Mahomes. The jury's still out on Josh Allen.
I look at Josh Allen, and I look at the head coach that he's with.
He's got a good head coach. And Sean McDermott's a really good head coach.
I think that they will be here more often than not. How many times we'll, of course, see. And crazily, this is the first time that Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers have ever played each other in a playoff game, which is also a pretty interesting dynamic, though, even with Brady's statistics this season, a different Tom Brady.
Not that crazy, right? They were in different conferences, and the Packers have only been to the Super Bowl but once in the Aaron Rodgers era. Just once.
Still interesting to think about that, because you would think that Rodgers would have made more Super Bowls by now, right?
That would be the assumption, given that he is considered the top quarterback of the post-Brady Manning. It went Brady-Manning, we're head-to-head, and then it was Rodgers, and now it's the era of Mahomes. And that brings me to, is Russ destined to be a middle child? Is Russell Wilson destined to be the... Because that's kind of where he is this weekend, right? If you listed the top four or five quarterbacks this season, well, he's probably top four or five, but his team isn't here. He's the one whose team didn't make it this far. And he's the one that's older than Mahomes, but younger than Rodgers. And he might end up being watch the baton passed right over his head as it goes from the debates about who the best quarterback in the game is.
What do you generally expect out of a middle child?
We should have Brock Heward here for this. The middle child is generally the one that feels left out, is generally the one that feels like never quite good enough. They weren't the first, so they don't get all the special treatment that comes with that. I would argue that being the firstborn is more difficult. The youngest is babied. It is unquestionably easiest for the youngest. Everybody loves everybody loves the younger person. Everybody's like, oh, isn't this great? And they want to make sure that they lap up every bit of it. The middle child just kind of gets overlooked.
I could see that being perhaps the case with Russell Wilson. I think now it's different, though, because how much longer are we going to see Brady play? How much longer are we going to see Rodgers play? Rodgers still is playing at a high level, so you'd think that he's maybe got at least 3-4 years left in him, though. Maybe they won't all be in Green Bay, given what they did at quarterback drafting Jordan Love. And Russ now, 32 years old, I think there will be a time where we look at Russ as the old guy. Oh, it's the old man coming out for one last ride, and we'll probably say that a couple of times. But yeah, right now he is sort of caught in between, and I imagine this weekend, it's got to be difficult. If I were in Russell's shoes, and he has a different personality, but there are times where I have wanted him to be petty and dislike guys like Mike Pettine or Richard Sherman, hold grudges. And if I were watching this game or these games this weekend, I wouldn't want to be Russ, because you've got a lot of things that could potentially happen and you just have to sit back and watch it. It's another Super Bowl appearance for Tom Brady, the guy that he is chasing. It's Aaron Rodgers making his second Super Bowl ever, which as far as making it to Super Bowls would tie Russell Wilson. Josh Allen, a guy who had a lot of issues last year, all of a sudden fixes them in one offseason? What? And then with Patrick Mahomes, in his fourth season in the NFL, Mahomes would have as many Super Bowl appearances, would have an MVP to his name, a season where he led the NFL in passing touchdowns to his name. That would be frustrating if you're Russell Wilson.
I think he looks at it more as what he could do if he was in a similar circumstance. I think that's how he's wired, more than sort of rooting for other guys not to accumulate more accomplishments than him. I think that's how he thinks about it, that he does want to be the best. And he does set that as a marker for himself. But I think he is someone who is, as opposed to, I hope this guy doesn't beat me there, thinking, would I be able to get there quicker if we did some things like this? That tends to be how I think he's wired. I think he sees himself as a peer, and I think he's competitive with those guys. But I don't think his level of there's not a level of disliking or rooting against guys that he's competing against.
Okay, well, if that's the case, then go back to circumstance. Are those circumstances better than the one that's right here? Markedly better, or is it just marginally? Because I think it's just marginally. I don't think there's a big gap separating the Seahawks from these teams, specifically the NFC ones.
I would agree about the gap. The Chiefs run a different offense, and that would be specifically what I would want to know from Russ, if he would ever be totally honest and just tell us what he thinks, is what he thinks he would do in that offense. What does he think he would be capable of doing if he was operating in that offense? And Mahomes scrambles some. So there is a little bit of a comparison there, because Mahomes does move more than other guys. I would want to know a little bit. Josh Allen is a guy that he's got such a big arm and makes huge. He can really fling it. Allen runs different, right? Like, he's not the same kind of runner as Russ. He runs.
He's a tank.
He's not as. Yeah, he's big. He's more like Cam Newton than he is like,
yes,
Russell Wilson.
Great comparison.
That sort of conflict. And then I think he looks with the Packers, and I think it'll be a question of, man, I hope he sees in the Packers what can happen when you create a formidable run game to allow your quarterback to separate himself. Because I think of all of the different offenses that are playing this weekend, that's the one that the Seahawks sort of would most hope to emulate under Pete Carroll. I don't think you have any chance of Pete Carroll going down the Andy Reid route. Like, that's a bridge too far for him. I hope when he looks at it this weekend, he sees, and in that way, I don't want the Packers to win, but if they were to, that it would be part of the sales job on Russ, seeing that, hey, running the ball more. And I don't know that Russ is against that per se, but I want him to see that, hey, lessening the pressure on the quarterback can actually allow the quarterback to function at a higher level.
That would definitely be beneficial for him to see. Maybe it's playoff Lenny with Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers that would potentially make him think that way. Yeah, the Packers are the circumstance that you would like him to see the most. It's not just the way that the Chiefs go about things where they don't run the football. The amount of weapons that they have is stupid. And, I mean, you're just never going to have that many. This might be the greatest array of speed that we've ever seen one NFL team have, between Tyreek Hill, Travis Kelce as far as tight ends go. Then after that, DeMarcus Robinson, Mecole Hardman, Sammy Watkins. It's just a fast team. I'm sure Russ would love to be on a team like that. Good luck. I mean, this is a video game caliber offense. So looking at what the Packers are doing, where there's really just one wide receiver that jumps out past everybody, and a running back core that has three guys who are promising going forward with A.J. Dillon. Jamal Williams did pretty well last week, and
yeah,
of course Aaron Jones, who's going to be a free agent this offseason. This is the one that, yeah, I think we would all like to see Russ sit back, say, yeah, we got to do things like this, because that would mean that he's maybe back on the same page with Pete Carroll, which is something that some people suggest he's not.
And I don't know. I honestly don't know where that winds up. And probably some of it depends on what the decision is at offensive coordinator. And we do have a new name, Joe Lombardi, who has been the quarterback's coach with the Saints, a couple different stints where he's worked with the Saints, sandwiched around. And Paul, you had looked this up. I didn't realize this, that Joe Lombardi, who is the grandson of Vince Lombardi, has some local roots.
Yeah, he went to Seattle Prep before a stint at the Air Force Academy, and he was actually born here, so I guess he moved around a little bit. As a kid, he lived in Washington, New York, and Michigan, but yeah, he's from here. So you got the local ties, which is great, and you found some other stuff, too, that we didn't know about his dad.
Joe Lombardi, Vince Lombardi Jr., who is Joe Lombardi's father, worked on the Seahawks staff, which I just wasn't aware of. It's obviously pretty clear, but So his roots, and he's got some ties to the area. So it's possible that that will be someone Seahawks have at the very least asked for permission to interview him. It is Danny and Gallant. We're going to have Michael Bumpus in at the 8 o'clock hour. But right now we tell you what to watch for.
What to watch for every morning at 7:10. Brought to you by Dubin Law Group. The first look at the stories worth watching today with Danny and Gallant.
All right, Bucks Packers is the first game at noon. I got them backwards. Bucks Packers. So they do let the old men play first, and then it'll be Bills Chiefs. That'll be in the afternoon on Sunday. I think the favorites in this game are the home teams, right? The number one seeds, the Packers and the Chiefs. Which game do you think is going to turn out to be better?
I think it's going to be Bills Chiefs. And maybe I'm thinking too much about the first games between both of these teams earlier this year, because both of these teams played each other in, I think, October. The first Bucks-Packers game was a blowout. And I feel like there is a chance for that to happen again. They had six sacks of Aaron Rodgers in that game.
Rodgers played terrible.
Right.
Bad pick six.
Right. And they were up 10-0, and they allowed 38 straight points, where that Buffalo-Kansas City game was just thrown off entirely by a bad day of weather in Buffalo. So I think it's going to be Bills-Chiefs. That's the more entertaining game. I don't know that the Bucks win in a blowout, but I do feel like the Bucks are a great matchup for Green Bay.
What to watch for.
In addition to that news about Joe Lombardi being a potential offensive coordinator candidate for the Seattle Seahawks, the Philadelphia Eagles hired Nick Sirianni as their new head coach. I'd never heard of him until yesterday. Also, former Seahawks offensive coordinator Daryl Bevel is expected to be hired by the Jaguars. Backstory for Sirianni, Nick, is that he was the offensive coordinator for the Indianapolis Colts, which probably means that they're trying to dial back up the Carson Wentz magic again if someone's coming over from Frank Reich's staff.
Exactly. We got the man who smells most of Frank Reich. Whoever gives off the strongest whiff of his musk, his quarterback whispering. We're going to bring him in here. Had he called plays before? Did he call plays in Indianapolis? No, he didn't. Interesting. One of the main reasons and arguments that people have provided for why Eric Bieniemy has not gotten hired, well, it doesn't seem to apply to this fella. He didn't call plays either.
If the Texans don't hire him, that's going to be really interesting. And I one of my
just
old
look, it looks terrible.
It does. My old producer in Houston tweeted this picture out of what it would be like for the Texans to bring in Bieniemy right now and have him at the introductory press conference. It wouldn't be a good look, but that's his only option. And I suppose that's what we're rooting for right now. What's interesting is that Deshaun Watson would have perhaps made that move happen.
What to watch for.
Got a little bit of hoops hardwood. The Huskies, can they double their Pac-12 win total? Are they going to be on a hot streak?
Oh, I hear excitement in your voice. You're talking yourself back into it.
No.
Tournament time.
No. That's not me. That's not me. They're going to play against Utah. And it's Utah's coaches. Both of them look as if you had a full all-out brawl with the other coaches in the conference that they would win. Certainly Kyle Whittingham is just, it looks like he's built like a brick staircase, as my father would say about Wonder Woman and Linda Carter. And Larry Kostrowiak is an absolute monster as well. I would not want no part of him. Utah's a tough team, always been tough for the Huskies.
You've also got the Cougs playing Colorado and the Zags, our beloved Zags, number one, everybody, still. They play the Pacific Saturday night.
Pacific, the Tigers.
Mm-hmm.
They should get in a real conference, shouldn't they?
I would definitely enjoy watching them more.
Trick question. The Pac-12, not a real conference right now.
Should
they lose their Power 5 standing? Just overall, it's been 16 years since they've had a national champion in football. No Pac-12 team has made the college football playoffs since the Huskies did it in 2016. They haven't had a basketball national champion in 24 years. That was UCLA winning it there in Seattle.
It's been a while for the Big 12, too, though, right, as far as football championships. Does it go back to Texas in 2006 as far as the last Big 12 national champion? So, well, they have some basketball ones, I think, probably from Kansas since then, off the top of my head. I feel like the Big 12 is still sort of in that same kind of conversation.
Okay, so there's a Power 3 And right. then there's
the middle children.
The two conferences that are kind of have the wheels knocked off of them. That is what to watch for. It's time to bring in the professor now for our morning drive.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Professor, the Seahawks are reportedly interested in Joe Lombardi, a guy who spent a lot of time as a quarterback coach with the New Orleans Saints, but was an offensive coordinator 2014 and halfway through 2015 before a 1-6 start, saw the entire Lions coaching staff sent packing in 2015. So what do you make of Joe Lombardi, and is this a realistic option for the Seahawks at OC?
Yeah, I think it's a realistic option because he's called plays. You know, he comes from that Sean Payton staff. I mean, he's been around. He's, as mentioned by Danny, you know, he's been in Seattle growing up here at Seattle Prep and going to school there. So I think that he could be intriguing. You kind of get the idea that they are waiting for one or two guys, you know, particularly that are on teams that have games this weekend. And so he might be one of the ones that they're waiting for. You know, Kirby Wilson, of course, is, you know, getting the interview. He's from the Raiders and had been with Pete for so long. But, you know, you got to start getting down to the point now where you got to start making decisions. And so, you know, you figured this now is going to go into next week. But I think Joe Lombardi, but the one thing I wonder about, and I've been kind of surprised about, is that Sean Payton not blocking a lot of the good coaches he has on his staff from going. Like, he let Aaron Glenn go from the secondary coach to Detroit as the defensive coordinator. He's lost a couple other guys too. Certainly he lost Danny Campbell. Of course, you can't stop him from getting a head coaching job. And so they almost lost one coach to LSU. And so you start wondering, you know, they're going to lose a lot of players. You know, they're going to lose Drew Brees because that looks like he's going to retire. And it's like, now you're going to be losing most of your coaches. And so you wonder, I don't know if his contract is up, Lombardi, or not. But yeah, you kind of wonder about that. You know, would he allow him to have the interview next week if they lose? But of course, if they don't lose, and New Orleans, well, of course, New Orleans is available. But I just kind of wonder. I shake my head a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a new rule this year, right, where assistant coaches can interview for, they don't need permission to interview for a coordinator job.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Or am I wrong about that?
You still have, if you're under contract, I mean, you still can be blocked because, again, if it's considered to be not a lateral move, but there's a little bit more freedom, but not necessarily total freedom. Because, like, for example, I know that Sean McVay blocked his offensive coordinator, or, you know, not offensive coordinator, because from, you know, talking to Brandon Staley and going down to maybe the Chargers. So, you know, it depends on the situation, but more than anything else, it depends on the contract and it depends on the coaches.
John, there is a part of me that's excited about being able to say Sirianni since the Eagles hired Nick Sirianni, but why did they hire him? It feels like not a very good hire, because I hadn't really heard about him until yesterday.
Yeah, but what it comes down to is that, you know, he worked with Frank Reich. Reich endorsed him, and in the case of Sirianni, he's going over there to try to fix up Carson Wentz because they wanted somebody that, you know, because Frank had done such a good job when he was in Philadelphia working with Wentz, and so now with Doug Peterson gone, you know, they wanted something that kind of fit, and, you know, because he worked with Frank Reich, and, you know, he worked with, he didn't call plays, obviously, because Frank Reich called all the plays, but, you know, he is a good coach. But and also, hey, I think the biggest thing more than anything else is it kept him away from hiring Joshy Boy McDaniels.
Yeah, how serious was that consideration for Josh McDaniels?
Well, they interviewed him for 9 hours, and at one point, because it was a six-hour interview for Sirianni, but, you know, for 9 hours, and after that interview, it appeared that he was the leading candidate. But now in Sirianni, you know, they get somebody that they think is, you know, young enough, good enough, and trying to be one that can try to resurrect what went wrong with Carson Wentz.
John, I'm fairly happy that Brandon Staley is out of the NFC West, going to the AFC West, and I realize that probably the person who's going to benefit most from this, if it was possible to buy stock in Joey Bosa, I would do that right now. I think that Staley is going to put Bosa in position to have an absolutely monster season.
I can see that. I mean, he was pretty good this year, despite some injuries. But, yeah, I think that he can. And that's they've got talent on that defense, you know, because, you know, Melvin Ingram, and you start to to look around. There's some good talent there. And so, yeah, I think this is going to be an interesting fit to see how he can do. I mean, it was kind of interesting because, you know, one of the reasons that Sirianni was hired before Brian Daboll, because I think Brian Daboll was also in the mix in Philadelphia, and the same thing with the Chargers, is that they just didn't want to wait because, you know, Daboll's still coaching in Buffalo. Buffalo's still in the playoffs, and if Buffalo goes to the Super Bowl, then you might not be able to get him before the Super Bowl as a head coach. But the interesting part about Daboll is that Tom Telesco, the general manager, went to the same high school as Brian Daboll. You know, he was 2 years behind him, and they both played on the same football team back in New York. And so, you know, it's interesting that Daboll may have been the choice over Sirianni, but nobody wanted to wait.
The Chiefs and Bills played earlier this year in a weird game in Buffalo after it had been delayed due to COVID-19. It was windy. And Kansas City won that game fairly convincingly. We also saw the Buccaneers blow the Green Bay Packers out earlier this season. Those games long, long ago, and things have changed since then. What team has improved the most since those two matchups that we saw earlier this season?
Well, the Bills have been pretty good all season, but I'd have to say that the Bucs has probably improved the most because, you know, once they had that terrible 38-3 loss to the New Orleans Saints in Tampa, you can see certainly Tom Brady getting better and better each week, throwing the ball better downfield. They seem to get more on the same page with Bruce Arians. And, I mean, you look at his numbers now in the second half of the season, they've been really good. Now, again, the Bucs are a 60-40 passing team. You know, Seattle was in the same way. But what I'm going to be curious of in this game, because you mentioned and talked about, you know, how Green Bay is good running the football because they have the seventh best percentage of runs. But last week, it was kind of curious that Tampa went to New Orleans. And again, no weather conditions or anything like that because it was in a dome. They ran the ball 35 times and they dropped back to pass 34. So I'm wondering, you know, are they going to use a little bit more run in this game, knowing that the weather conditions may not be the best? I guess it looked like earlier in the week it was going to be in the 20s with 1 to 3 inches of snow. But now it looks like temperatures could be in the 40s.
Oh, balmy. Yeah. Man, I thought this last week watching that game in Green Bay. I was like, I've gone and covered this game five times maybe over the course of my media career. And it's always, if it starts to snow in Green Bay, it's bad news for whoever's playing there. It just is. Like, it feels like once that happens that all you just might as well cash it in because it's the Packers, that's the kind of game they win. I felt a very strong sense of deja vu, John.
Yeah, no doubt. I still remember almost getting frostbite on the field when I was doing ESPN on Sunday when the temperature was like -8 and the wind chill was in the -30 range and all that stuff. And, you know, I'm out there without a heavy coat trying to do a TV hit right before, you know, countdown. And so it's like, but yeah, it's brutal. And I still remember the line that was used that any of the Packer fans in that weather, when it was that cold, had to go to you know, get two beers, and by the time you put the first beer on the ground, it was frozen.
Yeah, little icicles in there. Yeah. I could imagine. I could totally see that happening. Yeah, it is a frosty reception.
John, we might be burying the lead here, but the Cincinnati Bengals are going to get new uniforms. What kind of stripes would you like to see them have?
I don't care. It doesn't bother me. I have no idea, no interest in, because I don't care about uniforms.
What if they went full tiger stripes, John? Like full, instead of just on the side, the piping down the pants, they were just fully in tiger stripes.
I just think the biggest thing is they need to wear uniforms. It's a very important
thing. They need to wear them. Okay.
Just
Professor,
wear them.
Professor, we appreciate it. We're going to look forward to listening to you tomorrow morning. Is it 8 to 11?
8 to 11, taking your phone calls.
We'll look forward to that, John, and we'll talk to you next week.
John.
Okay, sounds good.
That is the professor. Now, hurry up. We got to get moving. We need to get going. That's what Russell wants. Yes, a hurry-up tempo will tell you who would provide that for him at the helm of the offense next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
We have some really sad news in the world of sports. One of the most iconic figure to ever play a sport, Hank Aaron, passed away at the age of 86. He was, I think, Danny, perhaps, of all the athletes that we've seen in history, one of the most mentally strong ones to be able to, in the Deep South, break what was arguably the most sacred record in sports, the home run all-time record held by Babe Ruth, while in Atlanta. I don't think I have the capacity to fathom just how much he had to go through in his own personal life off the diamond as he chased that award, or as he chased that record, and as he passed it. Really just a bummer of a news to wake up to.
He was 86. It happened this morning. I'm not old enough to remember watching Hank Aaron play. I was born in 74. His career, I think, ended in 76. Any baseball fan knows the number of home runs he hit, though. 755. It's one of the iconic numbers. 61. All of the different numbers that 61 home runs in a season, 755, that kind of came under assault during the later era in baseball. Who I knew Hank Aaron as a sports fan, was sort of this voice of restraint and someone who was about just a level of class and dignity, I think, is the best thing.
Yeah.
One of my favorite stories, Bill Plaschke, who is a columnist at the LA Times and has been one of the best sports writers in the country for a long time. When John Rocker, after the entire sort of deal happened where he said all of the offensive things in Sports Illustrated, kind of became a pariah, he pitched a game in LA, and a fan ran out and mooned him, like showed him his bare butt. And Plaschke wrote a column that said, finally, someone showed John Rocker what it felt like to look in a mirror, showed him his reflection, kind of celebrating this guy doing it. And Plaschke tells a story about getting a call from Hank Aaron, who just tells him what a terrible column he wrote. It's like, that's just an awful idea, that you're endorsing trespassing, you're endorsing this dropping down to this level of mooning a man, and Plaschke said the level of disappointment in Hank Aaron's voice was just heartbreaking. And
yeah.
He is and has been a level of conscience in a sport that desperately needed it through some of these different. He never hit more than 50 home runs in a season. Like he never hit 50 home runs in a season. He was a model of consistency and yet set the all-time most hallowed record of career home runs. Rest in peace. That's a bummer.
It really is. 25-time All-Star.
That's wild, isn't it?
That's insane.
Like that consistency, like when you say he hit the most home runs of anybody ever, but he never hit 50 in a season.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of like George Foster, who's a pretty good player and won it. He hit 50 home runs in a season. Hank Aaron never hit 50 home runs in a season, and he set the all-time record. That is so unbelievably consistent.
Batting champion, Gold Glove Award winner, home run leader in the season, RBI leader. Yeah, what an incredible career. And
an anti-mooner.
Yes.
Did not like mooning. Was firmly against mooning.
He did not. It's Danny Gallant. He is Danny O'Neill. I am Paul Gallant. Paving the way for Joe Buck. A disgusting act. Russell Wilson is looking for pace with whoever is the next Seahawks offensive coordinator. I decided, Danny, to go back through his end of season press conference that took place last Thursday and his, oh boy, we just lost a game to the Los Angeles Rams press conference, to hear if there was anything that he had put out there. And he said the word pace a lot.
Teams know that we throw it down the field well and all that kind of stuff. But I think also, too, that the teams also, what they fear is there our pace, the tempo and all that. I think that, it's like, I think you all know, but like when the game's on the line, it's 2 minutes in the game or whatever. I think teams obviously fear that, because of the feeling of, me going and all that stuff. And I think that's something that I think along the way that, you can kind of lose track of a little bit. And I think we kind of lost track of that maybe, along the way. I think that could have helped.
How do the Seahawks get pace in their offense? Because, I mean, at the very end there, a little dismay, if not disgust, that they were not able to have that pace.
Yeah. It starts with getting the play call in, right? Like, that's the first spot. And I don't think Russell is immune from some of this at the deliberate pace that they'll play early in games. I do think they're at their best when I think they're great in two-minute situations. I think they're better at two-minute situations than they are at four-minute situations, which probably isn't what you'd expect from a team that wants to run the ball. I completely agree, if only because accelerating the pace would reduce the number of times a timeout has to be called because the play clock is expiring.
I know.
So sign me up.
Yes.
Sign me up entirely for increasing the pace
of
play.
We are so on the same page on that one. My God. That's you know what? That's the only reason I want pace. Just stop with these awful delay of games and timeouts that they have to call last second.
Can we ask the clock operator, like when the Seahawks have the ball, can they ask to have the play clock set ahead by 5 seconds? Like, so it looks like it's going to run out 5 seconds before it does. Like some of the little tricks that people will play on themselves.
That might help.
That might help if you set the play clock ahead.
I have that in my apartment. I have it set up where all my clocks are slightly ahead so that I get going a little bit more quickly in the morning. The clock in my room is 2 minutes ahead. The clock in the kitchen is 5 minutes ahead. And the clock in my living room is 10 minutes ahead.
What are the best teams at playing fast? The Patriots were one of the teams, and this would have been, it's probably about 10 years ago now, but 8 to 10 years ago, they really did try to accelerate the pace. They tried to use some of the same things that Chip Kelly did, where it was really going about as fast as an offense can possibly go. I didn't have a great handle on who the faster teams are in pace of play.
Based off of Football Outsiders, which, to simplify things, puts together this rankings of essentially situations where a team is not down by 10 points and it's not the fourth quarter or overtime. And per them, the team that had the best pace last season was Arizona. After that, it's Dallas, Tennessee, Tampa Bay, interestingly enough, and Los Angeles, the Chargers, which maybe explains why there have been so many names from the Chargers that have been included in this offensive coordinator search. Tennessee is the one that I would probably focus on the most, Danny, as far as the offense that we have seen out of them the last couple of seasons, because it's not just that they established pace, but they also ran the football a lot and ran play action a lot. Russ is great at play action. Pete seems to want to run the football a lot more.
Yeah, sign me up for every pass should be play action for the most part. I don't see the downsides to play action. And you don't have to run the ball well, but you do have to run the ball for play action to work. Like you have to spend time running the ball. It can't, there's no evidence that points to having a good run game makes the play action better, but there is that you have to force teams to honor the run and you have to make them defend it before to make play action successful. Tennessee's a good one. There's nothing Ryan Tannehill does that Russell doesn't do better. And if you look at what that offense has brought out of Ryan Tannehill, I think you'd look at it and say, yeah, sign me up for that. Is Carson durable enough to do what King Henry does there, though?
That's a good question. I don't know. And, I mean, we've seen from an injury standpoint that has not been the case. Is there somebody else that you bring in? And it's also difficult, I think, to play with pace if you're checking running backs in and out of games, too. But running with pace, running the football with pace, I mean, if you're getting to the line of scrimmage more quickly and you're handing the football off, those defenders are going to get gassed if your running game can actually work, theoretically, a lot more quickly than they would perhaps in other situations.
The Rams are clearly, I love the Rams offense. I really like the way, and I think they're able to do different things with it. This year, I felt with Cam Akers, they ran between the tackles. It seems like it's an offense that is built to accentuate its players' skills rather than something that demands people be cogs. I love the Rams offense, but I'm not sure how much you can borrow from that because, I mean, right now you've got Brandon Staley. If anybody's going to be taking guys from that staff, who's going to be looking there?
And there are a couple of other things to keep in mind when it comes to pace, too. Really quickly, the first one is that take a look at Chip Kelly and pace. Chip Kelly's pace hurt his defense. They were not on the field long enough because they tried to run as many plays and go no huddle essentially every single play. it made their defense tired. And if you ask any defender who played that season, I mean, they played basically 100, 200, maybe even more than that plays than just about any other team in the league. They were gassed at the end of most games. And in the fourth quarter, your defense, you know, you can't win the game in the fourth quarter if your defense has been on the field the whole game.
Why is the defense more tired than the offense in that? If that was the case, shouldn't the opponent's offense get just as tired?
You would think, but I think it's a little bit different when you are the defense out there,
yeah,
especially if the
offense
you're having
to react
the pace. Right, yeah. So there's that perspective. And also, you know, just off of what we've seen out of Pete Carroll, is it possible for pace to work here? And I ask that question because we have seen this team consistently have the same issues getting to the line of scrimmage and having to call timeouts at the last second. This also feels like it's just a simple situational football thing. And for whatever reason, it has not been a priority for Pete Carroll and company.
But they do it at the end of halves and the end of games.
They're right.
Really good at it in those scenarios.
Right.
So I would tend to – they can. They can do it. We see them do it. Can they commit to doing it more frequently? They generally tend to use it as in out of necessity in those end of half and end of game situations, and then as something to try and jumpstart it if they're not going well. But I would think that, yeah, instead of using that as something to that you turn to out of necessity, use it as a weapon. Use it as something that you can do. And maybe it does takes a commitment from Pete to get out of the way a little bit and to let him go and be able to get the play in sooner before the play clock starts winding down.
That is Danny O'Neill. I'm Paul Gallant. It's Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle. Coming up next, Pete Carroll has changed offensive coordinators now for a third time. Is that perhaps too many times? Just about right? We'll answer that question for you next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Pete Carroll is not a meddling defensive tyrant like Mike Zimmer. Let's be fair here. That comes from the 425. And you're right. Zimmer's now looking for another offensive coordinator. I saw that Gary Kubiak is going to retire. He's retiring for the second time. Zimmer has had a number of different offensive coordinators. Some have gotten better jobs, like Kevin Stefanski. Other guys have just flat out left, like Norv Turner, because it's been tough to work with him. This is Pete has changed offensive coordinators. This is the third time. It's the third time in that they've parted ways. I would say fired, but this was characterized as a mutual parting of ways. But this is the third time there's been a change, not for the reason that the other guy got a promotion. This is the third time he will be on his fourth offensive coordinator. It'll be entering his 12th season. I don't know if I would say that that's a lot and he grinds on him, but it does make me wonder, has he struggled to pick the guy that is going to best fulfill his vision for the offense or maximize his quarterback?
That is a good question to ask, but maybe we should look at it from a different perspective. How long does a successful coordinator last in this league before they go on to greener pastures? There's that element of it, first off. Now, that hasn't necessarily been the case here, but there's also, maybe we should look at coordinators as something that you change the same way that you change the oil in your car. You don't necessarily want to do it, and you don't think that you necessarily need to do it all the time, but sometimes it's just better to have a different offensive mind or a different defensive mind come in and introduce different ideas, because if you do the same thing over and over again, eventually you will get stagnant or, worse, found out.
And you're not maybe challenging your players in the same way. And that's not to say that a coach doesn't create new opportunities in an offseason or change things or introduce things, but it's not having a different voice. There is a value in that. Offensive coordinator, you can't just say, hey, here's the average tenure, because there's different reasons dudes leave.
Right.
And I'm firmly of the opinion that, hey, if you hire guys who then get hired to be head coaches other places, that's a great thing. And you should never turn down somebody. The Rams are better off for having Brandon Staley as the defensive coordinator, even if it was for a year. Bringing in young, talented, aspirational coordinators, guys who are going on and going to be hired to do that's a good thing. That's not what's happened with Seattle, at least on the offensive side. In each case, the guy that's moved on has not been hired away to a better job. It's always been Jeremy Bates continued to coach in the league and someone who I think most recently was with the Jets. Daryl Bevel, who's just hired as the Jacksonville Jaguars offensive coordinator, he took a year off but then caught on with the Lions and now is in Jacksonville. We'll see. I'm sure that Brian Schottenheimer will end up coaching again, but these are not changes that have been made because someone was knocking at the door and demanding their services.
In the moment, did the moves make sense? I think that's ultimately what you have to look at. And I would say in the case of Brian Schottenheimer, it made sense. The offense ran into a wall. And did you really feel like it was going to be different going into next season when it did feel like it was found out? And if you're Brian Schottenheimer, maybe you need to go somewhere else to determine what it was that maybe he stopped doing successfully. And also, if you're the Seahawks, too, rolling back with the same thing, it might work out. The guy might learn from his mistakes. But I think more often than not in a league like this, it's hard to recapture glory that you might have had moving the football. And I'd say look no further than Sean McVay. They're still trying to get back to what they were offensively. And it's been, what, a year and a half, 2 years since that offense has looked the way that we remember it for and the reason that Sean McVay has all this clout across the NFL?
It is Danny and Gallant. One of the other conversations that's happening in baseball revolves around Hall of Fame voting. And Curt Schilling, who is on the ballot right now, there's been a push by the baseball writers. The BBWA is what elects Hall of Famers in baseball. And there's been a push by some people to retract votes they had cast for Curt Schilling, most specifically because he has expressed support for the storming of the Capitol, the January 6th riot that occurred, and feeling that, hey, I don't feel comfortable with my vote still being counted. They haven't finished the tabulations yet, and so the question is, can you retroactively alter your vote? I'm of mixed mind on this because I get that citizenship matters. I don't know where you draw the line when it comes to, in my experience, I viewed it, and when I voted on awards, I'm judging their on-field performance. I'm not passing judgment on this guy's a good guy, this guy's a bad guy, this guy is so terrible he doesn't deserve to be recognized. If you were eligible to play and you played, that's what I'm judging. I'm not convinced I'm right about that. Like, I have definite sort of different feelings, and have, as I said, I'm of mixed mind. I lean toward, I don't know if Schilling is applicable here, because there was already a pretty fair chunk of evidence that if you were uncomfortable with Curt Schilling, this was the kind of direction that he was leaning.
Curt Schilling loves him some memes. Curt Schilling politically has been divisive and polarizing, if not obnoxious, for quite some time. There's a part of me that wonders why we care what an athlete's political opinion is compared to what the average citizen's political opinion is. And there is right and wrong, but I'm not here for that necessarily either. What I remember Curt Schilling for is pitching in Game 6 of the 2004 American League Championship Series with a tendon that was not connected to his foot and the bloody sock, and pitching 6 innings of unbelievable baseball in the Bronx against a team that he always claimed to hate, the New York Yankees, whether he was with the Diamondbacks or with the Red Sox. And that's what it should be about, right? I mean, And I understand the people that talk about what these guys are off the field, but Ty Cobb, in his biography, one of the greatest hitters of all time, bragged that he killed a man. And if we're going to get into this sanctimonious, well, the moral character of these guys off the diamond, then you're going to have to reevaluate basically the entire Baseball Hall of Fame. If you want to go through that process, fine, go ahead. But to me, the Baseball Hall of Fame is a museum to remember the best players that ever pitched in the game. And I would say for an entire region of the United States that Curt Schilling had a huge impact on baseball. You're just going to say, oh, no, he's not in the Hall of Fame because he put some stuff that are distasteful online? That, to me, is a reach, I think. But that's my personal opinion, and I'm a little biased there because, I mean, for me, that as a kid, that was a really huge moment for me watching baseball.
I tend to agree with you. It's not a slam dunk decision for me. Like, I can see the argument that I would put, and this is the thing that I struggle with. What if Darren Sharper was a little bit better of a football player?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's a serial rapist, has been accused of, And the details from those cases are horrifying. And he's not a good enough player to get into the Hall of Fame. So it spares voters from having to make that, because you can just say he's just not good enough. But if he was a better player, because he was a pretty good player, I don't think I can say, like, hey, yeah, put him in the Hall of Fame.
This is one of the reasons that it's good that there are voters, because it is subjective. Peter King actually brought that up with Darren Sharper back in the day. I would just say this, though. Let's not act as if actions and words are the same thing, right?
I would agree with you there. We're talking about somebody expressing an opinion versus an actual crime. We're talking about someone expressing a distasteful retrograde, or however you want to describe it, opinion, versus actual crimes against persons.
Yeah, exactly. What Sharper did is disgusting, period. And I totally understand why someone would be like, yeah, that guy, I don't care how good he was. But there have been other players that are like this, and all of a sudden now we decide that we're above a player like that getting into a Hall of Fame. It's strange, and I think that it's being done over opinions. That's too much. Some of these guys, I mean, just think about everyone who was playing in baseball from the 1960s and before. And on a day where Hank Aaron passed away, I mean, how many racists played baseball? Are we gonna go back in time and say, well, this guy probably was a racist, so we got to kick him out? Because those are opinions. And I'm not saying that those opinions that they had are right. I'm just saying, if you open this can of worms, you are going to go into Wonderland, essentially.
There's a moral qualification, because it part determines who's making the moral stance. It is Danny Gallant. We'll get Michael Bumpus in here. As Paul said, very sad news in baseball that Hank Aaron has passed away at the age of 86. Baseball's all-time home run king was 755. Michael Bumpus is joining us next.